They're real.
You do?
Then.
Something strange in your neighborhood. Who you gonna call?
Talking with Jerry Pippin, a former comedian. I guess you could say he's still a comedian now. He's traveled the length and breadth of the U.S., worked in Hollywood, had a production company out there, did comedy writing. As they say, the whole bit there and up in San Francisco. We're remembering Harold Ramis. He was an actor there in Chicago, a Chicago-born actor, I should say, writer-director. He recently died at 69. He was best known for his works at Ghostbusters. Those of us who were around remember that. Stripes, which he was a writer and director for Caddyshack. Bill Murray was there. And also Groundhog Day, some very funny comedic-type movies there. You don't see very many of those anymore. And I'm reading from a piece by Mark Cairo of the Chicago Tribune. Harold Ramis is one of Chicago's most successful comedy filmmakers. When he moved his family from Los Angeles to Chicago area in 1996, his career was still thriving, with Groundhog Day acquiring almost instant classic status upon its 1993 release, and 1984 Ghostbusters ranking among the best grossing comedies of all times. He was a member of the famous Second City cast there in Chicago. Murray was there, and many of those people went on to New York. He went also. They were on Saturday Night Live. A little bit more of his works here. The National Lampoon Animal House, which upon its release in 1978 catapulted the career of one John Belushi. Remember going to John Belushi's funeral. Ramis acted in at Second City. He did Stripes in 1981, Ghostbusters, in which he co-starred, plus his directing efforts in Caddyshack, 1980, The National Lampoon Vacation, 1983, and Groundhog Day, and Analyze This. He was also a head writer and performer on Second City's groundbreaking TV city, Second City TV. That was from 76 to 79. And most recently, he directed episodes of NBC's The Office. Well, Jerry Pippin, you were a producer, you were a writer, etc., out in Los Angeles. And Mr. Ramis, he moved his family from Los Angeles back to Chicago, saying that no one was from L.A. Your take.
Yep, he's right about that. Almost no one is from L.A. And when you get out there, it's first of all, it's kind of an interesting place to go. If you're in the business, you start meeting people. And my first impression of meeting some of these people that were names on television and in movies was that they were usually older than you thought they were. The problem there, I guess, is it takes a while to get to be an overnight success. Now, Ramis is probably best known in the business for his ability to write intellectual but gut-wrenching, funny stuff. In other words, he's one of the few guys that compare and combine a little bit of slapstick with some intellectual thinking. And he did that over and over in his movies, and many of those movies that you named off there, Boston Red, appeared in the 70s and 80s, and he basically, that was a golden time for comedy, especially for the comedy type of material that he did, and that was the fact that it was almost avant-garde. In other words, it appealed to the youth of America, and part of it started because of his background in Second City in Chicago, which was kind of an improv house. And that type of comedy is structured around people being in and, you know, grabbing the audience on in as well as being, you know, a mover and shaker. Now, one of the interesting things about that is that he used me, the same type of comic that did that, that type of material. And I think about John Belushi, and, you know, we could go on and name, and I think he named quite a few of them. And they were people that back in the prime of Saturday Night Live, and then later for all the movies, which were really spinoffs, or I call them takeoffs, of modern life. And Chevy Chase was another one of his favorite actors. He had good friendship with everybody. And it was interesting, he just wanted to go back home, back to Chicago. And that's certainly couldn't identify with that. I'm back home and had been back home in Melville Town of Muskogee. It's a far cry, that's in Oklahoma, far cry from Chicago in Illinois. But I can certainly identify with a guy who just wanted to go home. And it's something very refreshing about being able to walk the streets and know the people that you grew up with. And it's a comfortable feeling. And for a writer and for a creator, especially if you write comedy, which is not an easy job, by the way, and it's not a fun job, but it is a job that you do get instant results. There's nothing better in the whole world than, you know, appearing in front of an audience and all of a sudden them laughing and giving you all their laughs, and then you get a standing ovation. It's just something that that you can't really describe. It's the highest of the high. And Arimas was able to walk away from the Hollywood scene. Even if they did do that later, and he can still work with all of the Hollywood giants in the comedy area. But at the same time, he went back home with his family, and a lot of people didn't realize it, but he had a very serious, strange disease. And I believe Boston Med, if it's one of those diseases that caused your blood vessels to swell up. Is that right?
Right, yeah. Your blood vessels swell with this, and it evidently at one time caused him to not be able to walk properly, and he had to learn to walk again. And the problem with this disease, vasculitis, I think they call it, it is unusual, and it can be in any of the blood vessels. It can be usually in the legs, but it can be in others, and it's evidently one of those very painful diseases that probably there's not a lot they can do other than give you some, you know, anti-inflammatory drugs. You've had some of this, not a blood vessel disease, but you've obviously had some things with inflammation. So I'm assuming
yeah, when some you have this. Those painful things like that going on with you personally, there's really not much you can do except submit to pain pills and IVs and things like that. And you sometimes worry about the addiction, but on top of that, you're in such pain, and the pain is so excruciating, you're not going to care. You just, it needs your relief, you know?
Right, yeah. And
thank
and
God,
pain.
Modern medicine has come up with a few things that really work and do give pain relief.
I guess they do over time. I was talking with this Dr. Olson, who was a specialist in pain, and he was explaining to me it was kind of like a crapshoot. You got to literally experience, kind of like hypertension medication, which I'm more familiar with, you have to experiment with which painkiller a pain medication will work with that person and which combination with various other drugs. And it's not something you can just be in a doctor's office and the doctor can figure this out usually in 5 minutes. It's something that, you know, over time. And his situation, because it was so devastating.
They call his doctors pain management specialists.
Right, right. That's what
this
fellow
was. And that's exactly why they call them that, because you got to manage the pain, and it's not easy. One thing that might work on somebody, like magic, might not work at all on me at all.
And we're right. And in fact, this guy had a good background for that. He's an EE, an electrical engineer. So he had devices, or they have devices now that they can pinpoint, for instance, if the pain is in your left or right arm or right hand, wherever. And many times that pain is not where you think it is. It's kind of like the sciatica I had, which floating around. In other words, it could be in the back area, in the upper hip area, the leg area. It could go to the arm. It could be everywhere. But anyway, to get back to Harold.
Mr. Remus died back in his hometown.
Right, surrounded by his family. I think he was probably at the Evanston Medical Center. Okay, yeah, we are having a little technical problem. I can hear you better now than before. We'll go through it. Well, I want to talk to you a little bit, Jerry, since I've never written comedy or never performed comedy. You talked about the performance, but what about the writing? I understand from listening to interviews from Red Skelton and from various other people that were very good at writing comedy. It's not an easy thing to do.
No. As I alluded to earlier, it's a fun thing. It is much better written, and people laugh at funding to it the way you need. And there's many formulas in writing comedy, but some of it is left for inspiration. And the reason places like Second City and comedy clubs and things like that became popular is it was an easy way to work on your material. You could get write some things that you knew worked, and you could always use those. Then you throw in some new material, and if it worked, great. And usually it's kind of like the pain doctor. You do it four or five times because that's one of the interesting things about performing live. Comedy-wise, is you can be knocking on bed, as they say, getting standing room ovation one show, the second show, literally, they're yawning. I mean, there's just a lot of things involved in it, and writing comedy involves a lot of psychology, and you basically think about I did, and most of the writers I knew, they would think of the absurd and then turn it back maybe a notch or two, and that's the reason they called Remus an intellectual comic, and so that it would be believable, and they weren't actually insulting anybody's intelligence, but at the same time, it's something they could identify with. Remember, the first thing about writing comedy is it's the theater of the absurd. In other words, you can use, like Bob Hope or Red Skelton, using joke lines or skits, or you can do it like the modern comics, which literally set up things, and Bill Cosby was a master at that, telling stories that the people could identify with and laugh. So anyway, Remus, he was certainly a great talent, and certainly a great success.
Yeah, he was indeed.
You wonder if he went back to Chicago, makes you wonder if he picked that there, or is this a rest area, or what? I don't know that much about it.
Well, in Chicago, a little bit different situation there. I guess what happened, as with Second City, the comedy actors, what have you, all moved on, at least of his era, to New York. And the Second City operation became a second, I guess, because of you and all the comedy clubs a third or a fourth or a sixth city, I mean, in the sense of the talent. The talent got distributed all over the Americas and I guess all over the world. So it was a little different situation there. Now I don't hear as much about a quote-unquote second city, nor do you hear that much about the L.A. scene, I guess, unless you are out there in L.A. And, of course, the effects of the cable.
Basically, you appear at those clubs there, and clubs, improvisational clubs, ones that improvise. You appear there to sing, and talent has to go there and take a look at you. But basically, it never really happened quite that way. You know, a lot of time luring somebody over to see your act, and they would finally show up sooner or later, and if you were lucky, you were on that day. In other words, you at the time of the game. If you're unlucky, the problem is you'll get a second to make the first. So you have to write that box get off, or that producer off, and concentrate on somebody else until somebody recognizes your talent. It's a tough, tough business.
Yeah, I would imagine it is. And, of course, his game was a little different. He was not a stand-up comic. He was a man that wrote scripts for movies. And, of course, he also did a directing. I understand, Jerry, you even did a little bit direct directorial activities.
Well, we've had
I remember you did that.
Things on a small basis.
Right.
Years. And thankfully, one time I used to do Focus Hill and it's every night.
Okay. Yeah, I know you did some of the acting, and this is what he did. He had some parts in some of his.
We did it in Arkansas, and we would get students of drama or comedy to come down, and we would put things together.
Okay. Yeah, putting some of the movies.
You're breaking after here, and I can. I'm not getting everything technically here from you right now, Boston Red. So I'm going to wrap my part of it up. But
I can hear you pretty good at this. I just had one other question. The supply of writers, I guess, and obviously you need writers. We're doing pretty good now. Writers for the various skits, etc. Is the supply of writers still out there? Obviously, there's more outlets for comedy these days than there's ever been. Not the comedy clubs, but in terms of TV, like he did The Office for NBC. I mean, there's just endless number of programs that one can do. But you don't have, at least it doesn't appear to me, that you have the heavyweight comics that you had in the 60s, 70s, and into the 80s when it was his heyday with Chevy Chase.
The point is kind of twofold there. The first reason is you don't have the superstars that everybody knows about is because of supply and demand. Nowadays, there's so much programming out there that everybody has a show. And they do it, but the problem is they get lost. Like, there's 96 cable channels or whatever. How are people going to find you? And so originally, if you were lucky enough to be a major star and get a shot on one of the networks, basically you had 40 million people watching you. Now you're lucky if you got 4 million, and that would be a high-rated show.
Yeah, and you're lucky probably many times if you have 100,000.
Answer your question about the writing. There's always a shortage of writers. And the interesting dichotomy about that is there's also a shortage of anybody offering a writer a paying job. In other words, everybody wants a writer, but there's not that many people willing to pay for it. In other words, it's a business where what did you do lately? In other words, that's what they want to know.
Right. Yeah. I understand that.
And you're there.
It's trying to keep the job. Trying to make a living at the job. Anyway, I'll give you the last 2 minutes, Jerry. We seem to be doing a little better. We apologize for the technical difficulties. It's just one of those things that happen. And this is evidently a very good presentation that I wanted to do on the state of comedy. And we'll get some skits. We came in here with Ghostbusters, and we'll get some skits of his work and during his particular time. And the setting for this was that Reagan was in office at the time in the 80s when all these movies came out. And it was when the conservatives had taken over America, not the same conservatives we have today, but a totally different time. Out there, the Tonight Show, Carson was there. Carson was the master of the stand-up comedy, and you know, in those days. But you know, now you have Jay Leno, but you don't have, and Leno has left. You don't have the strong performers, even on the, I guess, Jerry Kimmel on the late night, you know, shows that we once that we once had. I guess the writers are busy, and as you say, they're being paid probably peanuts. So it's a very rough game. Anyway, I'll give you the last 2 minutes.
I don't regret my years in comedy. I enjoyed them very much. One of the most astounding things, or surprising, maybe is a better term to describe it, surprising things about the field of comedy, is that, first of all, many of the comics themselves, writers or performers, are more or less neurotic. And by that, I mean they got some few personal problems, and they use that comedy, a skill to make people laugh, to be accepted, among other things. And it's also a way of dealing with things that they thought were not there, and so they could get people to see the humor in things that really are very funny, if you think about it. You let some of the skits and some of the jokes, if you listen to them, they basically are on pretty serious subjects, but somehow, if you approach it just right, and if you don't come across too intense, and then you can get lots of laughs and become successful. But the key to it all and becoming successful is exposure. And that's the strange thing about the business. There's more outlets today than ever before. Cable TV, the internet even, you name it. It's all out there. But at the same time, it fragments the audience so much that there is very little opportunity to make a huge name for yourself, except for years and years and years of working.
Well, yeah, I'm thinking
like,
of...
Like Remus, a lot of people don't even know who he is now.
Right, he hasn't been out. Well, a fellow that you hired one time, Sinbad, he still appears occasionally at some of the clubs around the country, been in some movies, but it's been a very, very long time since, you know, Sinbad has had a big movie, or and a lot of people have forgotten old Sinbad, but, you know, he's out there. And one other question. I was thinking of when you were talking about actors or comics that had emotional situations. I guess we go back to Laurel and Hardy, but Jonathan Winter came along there. He had been had severe depression, had shock therapy, etc. Was a brilliant comic and a writer. And sometimes, you know, comics are comics, but not they don't necessarily write their own material. But and some do.
Well, yeah, and some producers of shows that hire comic and they do comic situations such as sitcoms or whatever believe, and they may be right, that other than stand-up monologues, the guy doing comedy, he probably is better off doing other people's material, because he's a little more objective. That doesn't mean everybody is that way. Naturally, there's some people that are just all around talented. And almost every comic can write some comedy. or they would never be able to survive. They couldn't afford to just hire a comedy writer out of the water. But you go to those clubs I was talking about earlier, the break-in clubs, such as, you know, the Comedy Store one time was a big one, and well, they're all over the place, and they were mentioned, of course, Reyes is stomping grounds, the second city. The point is, those guys work over and over every night, and practice makes perfect, and they hone down to some subject matter and skits that work. So then they do a little improv. It's not going over well. They go into something they know does work. It's one of those things that got to be objective and at the same time relaxed enough to think fast and furious to keep the audience with you.
Well,
because
yeah,
basically audiences get a little fickle. If you turn them off, you say the wrong thing.
I would guess so. Now, another question, Jerry, is the difference, I guess, performing before a live audience at a club or what have you, than doing a skit or what have you before, maybe there's a studio audience there, but for TV, like a Seinfeld or, you know, that sort of thing, where you're doing a, I guess, a comedy show. That's more than what Harold did, or a comedy movie. And, of course, people watch it, but, I mean, in other words, it's filmed first, and scripts have to be written, they have to be directed, a little bit different kind of situation.
That's right. And usually doing stand-up and writing your own material, getting some exposure, then you get hired for some of these sitcoms and movies, things like that.
Well, Eddie Murray comes to, you know, to there. He was, of course, on Saturday Night Live, and at the same time, he wrote for a lot of other people, and, of course, his movies were very successful when he did his movies. Again, we're back to a person primarily that did a lot of movies in the 80s, did some in the 90s. Occasionally, you see him today. But as you say, it's kind of hard to do. It's sort of like when you were doing comedy, you're not doing it now. But some of these guys and women were, you know, big names at one time, as with Howard. People would forget Howard. Howard was almost 70 years old. Other than he did The Office from behind the scenes. So he stayed, you know, in the game. But if you didn't follow his career, you had forgotten about him. And that's basically why we did the this show. Because we wanted to talk about comedy and where it is. And you and I have talked, of course, about fragmentation in not only that part of the business, but in the radio business. I listened to a little bit of what you were doing last night, which is the UFO game, which is not as fragmented, I think, as some of the other types of things, like the political stuff we're doing. Everybody and his mother is doing it out there. So it's, you know, it is different. The fragmentation is different, and you talked about that. But do you see, Jerry, and we will close this out, a silver lining to all this fragmentation? I mean, does it make it easier for a fellow like you than it would have if, you know, the big boys and big girls, the networks, the radio networks and everybody were running the UFO shows and they had Art Howell and whatever, whoever it was, out there. And now he has to not only compete against you, but 1,000 other characters.
It's true.
And
well, the silver lining is that, you know, you get a little money together. You can today go on the Internet and start doing shows. And basically, if you're lucky enough, you can get big enough of an audience and attract some people to help you create advertising revenue and for the show. And basically, that's how you make it these days. If you notice, a lot of people are going to the Internet first. Sometimes they come back to the Internet. And the reason is because it's the last bastion of entrepreneurship in the show business arena. Otherwise, the big corporations have eaten it all up.
You know, I'd not actually thought of this in that sense. How it is. Incidentally, we'll be heard now, and I just wanted to put this little plug in here. be heard on Podomatic. That is one of many, many podcasts out of Australia, of all places. So this will be heard there later in Australia time. It'll be up there tonight. But they have a mobile platform, Podomatic. You can go there on the web, and we'll put this particular one up. And they are out of, I believe, Sydney. So anyway, we'll be heard there in addition to, of course, on Blog Talk and on Spreaker. And you can find, where can they find you, Jerry?
Okay, I've been joined at Boston Red and got a little bit of a technical problem, so I didn't hear all of that. But
oh, well, no, I just asked where.
In Australia now.
No, I just asked where they could find you.
And when we talk about the Internet, that's one of the pluses. It's a worldwide medium.
Right, yes.
And
yes, it's just like your shows are heard in China.
National medium.
And they can hear you at jerrypippin.com. And you have many, many shows over there, over many things, the UFO genre and various other things, just as we were covering this one. Anyway, Jerry, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Sorry about the technical problems, but we unfortunately have them sometime. We'll talk to you soon, Jerry. Good night.
Okay, I don't know how much of the audience realized we had technical problems. It was just that I couldn't hear you sometimes.
Yeah, it's a little bit here, but the editing will take care of some of this, and we'll get this show out to Denver. Anyway, good night.
Good night, Boston Red.
Wound up and stayed here in Chicago.
Stayed here in Chicago. You know, I'm sad because he passed away, but as you're going down the list of movies, it makes me smile because that's what he did for generations with his films, all from his humble beginnings, graduating from Senn High School through this amazing career that took him to California, but returned him back home to Chicago, where today we lost one of the greats in comedy.
When I was a kid, my father told me, never hit anyone in anger unless you're absolutely sure you can get away with it.
The words that he wrote are some of the most quoted in film comedy history.
It's in the hole! It's in the hole!
Hey, many of his films are considered masterpieces. But Harold Ramis said that he knew that he wasn't going to be a huge comedy star the day that he got on stage with John Belushi at Second City. And while friends like Belushi, Dan Aykroyd, and Bill Murray did become superstars for their on-camera performances, Ramis became legendary for writing, directing, and producing classics that defined film comedy in the 70s through the 90s. There's Ghostbusters, National Lampoon's Vacation, Animal House, Stripes, Meatballs, and many more, including his first film after moving back to Chicago from L.A. in 1999, Analyze This, and its sequel, Analyze That, with Billy Crystal and Robert De Niro. Ramis died early Monday morning in his North Shore home from complications related to autoimmune inflammatory vasculitis, a condition that Ramis battled for years. A young boy growing up on the West Side and then in Rogers Park, he became the jokes editor for Playboy magazine and joined Second City in 1969. At the 2010 Improv Olympics Lifetime Achievement Awards ceremony, he remembered,
I moved back to Chicago at 67 after college, came to Second City and watched the show, which I'd never seen even though I grew up in Chicago, and I had a feeling a lot of people have, which is, geez, I could do that. But more important, I want to do that.
And do what he did. He became a performer and the head writer in the mid-70s for the SCTV comedy series before shifting to big screen comedy, where he'd stay for the next 40 years, writing, directing, and producing. In recent years, he directed a few episodes of TV's The Office and played Seth Rogen's father in the Judd Apatow 2007 comedy Knocked Up. Both Rogen and Apatow have said Ramis was one of their idols.
How do you process that? Because, I mean, you're a pretty normal Chicago guy. I mean, you live here and, you know, run about town like normal people do, but you're legendary at the same time.
Well, it's all relative, isn't it? I felt legendary when I lived in L.A., but then Spielberg would walk into the deli and, you know, everyone would stop talking to me. You know.
Harold Ramis was 69 years old. He survived by his wife, three children, and two grandchildren.
Really great sense of humor, and I would see him all the time. You know, as I'm out seeing movies and reviewing movies, you look a row or two ahead, Ramis is there with his kids. Hey, how you doing? He's eating popcorn. He's right. At charity events constantly with different charity and philanthropic events. Really, really.
Here.
Thank you.
I've been Chicagoans our whole life. How have we not gotten together before?
Now? It's a big city. But now, we're bonded now, I think.
So Ghostbusters 3 we keep hearing about. Is this going to happen?
Yeah. Bill was on Letterman the other night, and it's the first time he acknowledged it in front of a national audience. And he's on. Everyone's in it, except we're going to introduce new Ghostbusters. Ivan Reitman will probably direct. Script is being supervised by me and Ivan and Dan, and two young writers from The Office are working on the script.
You and Bill Murray had a falling out after Groundhog Day or something?
No falling out.
No? You guys still get along?
No, just decided never to speak.
Harold, how do you process, you know, you're being honored at this legendary thing, you know, and it says something about the esteem at which people hold you. How do you process that? Because, I mean, you're a pretty normal Chicago guy. I mean, you live here and, you know, run about town like normal people do, but you're legendary at the same time.
Well, it's all relative, isn't it? I felt legendary when I lived in L.A., but then Spielberg would walk into the deli and, and everyone would stop talking to me, you know. So location is very important. And longevity. You know, I mean, people are still watching these movies. That's what's incredible
to
me.
Do the people just quote the lines to you? Do you get tired of it? I mean, these are classics.
Every day, someone your age may say to me, I just made my kids watch Caddyshack. It's always, I made my kids watch it. You know? So they didn't choose to watch it. But they keep showing it. The generations are passing these movies along.
Well, how do you think Caddyshack has attained that? I mean, it's a... It's a top comedy of all time. Did you have any sense when you were making it that you were onto something special?
We thought we were so funny. We were so arrogant.
You were.
When we were writing Animal House, we thought, all right, this is going to be the most successful comedy of all time, and which is a grandiose thought every writer has when they start. I always say I start every project by writing my Academy Award acceptance speech. That's the reason. But then reality catches up with you. But in the case of Animal House, the reality was it was the most successful comedy. So we went into Caddyshack thinking, oh, we can do that again. You know, that'll be easy. And, of course, it wasn't as successful. But there are things about it that are so funny, people just keep coming back to the film.
Can I take you back in time, as we like to do sometimes with people who visit our show, to talk about how you kind of got started in all of this. I did read that you wanted to be maybe a doctor someday, but you fell into comedy somehow. Take a look at this. Do you remember this clip? Have you seen this in a long time? This is from SCTV.
Yeah. That's me.
Do-it-yourself dentistry.
The funny thing about that was, we were shooting very late. It was the end of a shooting day. And the joke and the thing was, you won't be licensed to give yourself shots of Novocaine, so I give myself shots of tequila. And what happened was Joe Flaherty, who was one of the funniest guys I know, put real tequila on the set. So as I did the piece, take after take, I had about 8 shots of tequila. By the end, I couldn't even see the cue cards. You know, it was unbelievable.
It was awesome.
What's your take on the current crop of, you know, comedies that are out there right now? Some, like Knocked Up, I think are really funny and really brilliant, and The Hangover, but a lot of it's awful, I think.
Same as always. I mean, and people thought my last film was awful. Some did. But it's the hardest thing in the world to be funny for 100 minutes. And Judd Apatow's movies are, as you know, over 2 hours. And you can't please everybody. Comedy is the most subjective thing of all the genres. It's very, very subjective. So they're trying, you know. It's no one sets out to do bad work. I always admire the effort. And sometimes the thing I most resent, though, is when there's absolutely no ambition or aspiration in it. They're not trying to say anything. They're shooting for the lowest common denominator, and that's hard to respect.
I read you're going to write a story about your life, set like in 1967 or something.
There's a script. My life's been interesting, I have to say. I'm like Forrest Gump. I hit every kind of cultural watershed at the right time. I was 13 when Elvis came along. I was 18 when John F. Kennedy was in the White House. I was, you know, 21 when the Beatles hit. And then I went to work in a psych ward in 1967, in a locked psych ward. And it was, I was like a full-blown, long-haired hippie and working in a loony bin, and the world was coming apart in Vietnam, and it was a real exciting time to be alive.
Wow.
Harold.